tiny in all that air. The Philip Larkin Society Podcast.
Hello and welcome to this very special episode of Tiny in All That Air that has been made with the generous help of many of our fantastic honorary vice presidents who have many different connections with Philip Larkin, the man and the writer. We begin with former Secretary of State for Health and Social Care, Alan Johnson, followed by Philip Larkin's biographer, friend and literary executor, Andrew Motion, and writer David Quantick's Reading of Days.
Hi, my name's Alan Johnson. I write books now and live in the countryside in the East Riding. I was the Member of Parliament for Hull West and Hessle for 20 years and was a big fan of Larkin before I went to Hull. But then I was very keen to find the bits in my constituency mentioned in his poem. And there are many, including The Large Cool Store, which was Marks and Spencer's in Whitefriar Gate, now sadly gone. Afternoons was in Pearson Park, not far away. But this one, the building, is Hull Royal Infirmary. And I'm going to read this to you first because I think it's an absolutely wonderful poem, one of his longer poems. But also because he wrote this in the early 70s, and about 13 years later, this is where he died. But it's not just a wonderful description of a hospital, but it brings in so many issues about social mobility, about people's housing conditions, because he's looking down from high up in Hull Royal Infirmary at what was then a nest of very poor housing that was surrounding the building. That's all gone now, thank goodness. But that's why it's got a special place in my heart, because it describes not just a major building in West Hull, but also the people and the area that he was in. Higher than the handsomest hotel, the Lucent Comb shows up for miles. But see, all around it, close-ribbed streets rise and fall, like a great sigh out of the last century. The porters are scruffy. What keep drawing up at the entrance are not taxis. And in the hall, as well as the creepers, hangs a frightening smell. There are paperbacks and tea at so much a cup, like an airport lounge. But those who tamely sit on rows of steel chairs turning the ripped mags haven't come far. More like a local bus. These outdoor clothes and half-filled shopping bags and faces restless and resigned, although every few minutes comes a kind of nurse to fetch someone away. The rest refit, cups back to saucers, cough or glance below seats for dropped gloves or cards. Humans caught on ground, curiously neutral. Homes and names suddenly in abeyance. Some are young, some old, but most at that vague age that claims the end of choice, the last of hope. And all here to confess that something has gone wrong. It must be error of a serious sort. For see how many floors it needs, how tall it's grown by now, and how much money goes in trying to correct it. See the time, 11:30 on a working day. And these picked out of it. See as they climb to their appointed levels, how their eyes go to each other, guessing on the way. Someone's wheeled past in washed to rags, ward clothes. They see him too. They're quiet. To realize this new thing held in common makes them quiet. For past these doors are rooms, and rooms past those, and more rooms, yet each one further off. And harder to return from, and who knows which he will see and when. For the moment, wait, look down at the yard. Outside seems old enough, red brick, lagged pipes, and someone walking by it, out to the car park, free. Then past the gate, traffic, a locked church, short terraced streets where the kids chalk gains and girls with hairdos fetch their separates from the cleaners. Oh, world, your loves, your chances are beyond the stretch of any hand from here. And so, unreal, a touching dream to which we all are lulled, but wake from separately. In it, conceits and self-protecting ignorance congeal to carry life, collapsing only when called to these corridors, for now once more the nurse beckons. Each gets up and goes at last. Some will be out by lunch or four. Others, not knowing it, have come to join the unseen congregations whose white rows lie set apart above. Women, men, old, young, crude facets of the only coin this place accepts. All know they are going to die. Not yet, perhaps not here, but in the end, and somewhere like this. That is what it means, this clean sliced cliff, a struggle to transcend, the thought of dying, for unless its powers outbuild cathedrals, nothing contravenes the coming dark, though crowds each evening try with wasteful, weak, propitiatory flowers.
I find it very difficult to believe that we're celebrating the 100th birthday of Philip Larkin, because he was such a strong presence in my life as such a large part of it, that I feel that in order to acknowledge it really is his centenary, I might as well acknowledge that it's my own centenary as well, which is clearly isn't. It would be a ludicrous thing to do. Partly what I mean by that is that my sense of the presence of his poems in my life has remained very, very powerful. I knew him best from the late 1970s when I went to work at the University of Hull. I went there, I think, in 1976 until his death a very little under 10 years later. And since then, as one of his literary executors, of course, I've had to stay very closely in contact with his spirit in various ways, and even more particularly, of course, when I was writing his life. It's true to say that, and this is not a controversial thing to say at all, that his reputation has in some sense undergone various changes since his death, and we've discovered more about the circumstances of his life. It was my very strong feeling as one of the executors early on that we should get everything out there and that the poems were quite good enough, thank you very much, in order to survive whatever brickbats people might throw at them and at him. And I have to say that I'm under the impression that that has, in fact, paid off, that strategy, that even though there are some people who take a dim view of his politics and there are very problematic things about those politics, nevertheless, the poems, the admiration for the poems, as things which make separations between themselves and the self that produced them, seems to me in very, very healthy shape. For my own part, my sense of the merit of the poems has done nothing but grow in the years since his death. And all the time that I've been working on him and thinking about him has only enhanced my sense of their very particular, humble seeming, but actually grand achievement. He has, to a quite extraordinary degree, entered the national bloodstream, I would say. And that's, of course, got a lot to do with the fact not only that he describes the experience of being human in terms which a lot of us can relate to very easily, regardless of our backgrounds and skin colours and so on, but also that the poems are written with a very shrewd eye on the quotable. In fact, a lot of them actually aspire to the condition of being quotable, I think, for all their modernity and the way in which they inhabit the time in which they're written. They very often have an almost Augustan sense of rectitude about them, in that sense of wanting to become lapidary. poem after poem settles into a phrase or a line which we remember, whether we want to remember it or not. And his admirers, of course, very much do want to remember them. That makes it, among other things, difficult to choose a single poem to read to represent his achievement. And I've decided to go for the absolute middle of the target and to read The Whitsun Weddings, a poem I've loved since I first read it 50-some years ago, and which has a lot of his most distinctive qualities on very fine display: the novelistic ability to include clutter and detail without the poem falling over itself. And especially, I think, which I will try and register as I read it, the sense of swelling towards a climax. And it's so typical of the poems that they start off by flying quite close to the ground, and mixing my metaphors a little bit here, and in the course of the poem, accelerate and lift off to some much more nearly rapturous ending. And that is profoundly true of this, I think, very beautiful poem. So, The Whitsun Weddings. That Whitsun, I was late getting away. Not till about 1:20 on the sunlit Saturday did my three-quarters empty train pull out, all windows down, all cushions hot, all sense of being in a hurry gone. We ran behind the backs of houses, crossed a street of blinding windscreens, smelt the fish dock, thence the river's level drifting breath began, where sky and Lincolnshire and water meet. All afternoon, through the tall heat that slept for miles inland, a slow and stopping curve southwards we kept. Wide farms went by, short-shadowed cattle, and canals with floatings of industrial froth. A hothouse flashed uniquely, hedges dipped and rose, and now and then a smell of grass displaced the reek of buttoned carriage cloth until the next town, new and nondescript, approached with acres of dismantled cars. At first, I didn't notice what a noise the weddings made each station that we stopped at. Sun destroys the interest of what's happening in the shade. And down the long, cool platforms, whoops and skirls I took for porters larking with the males, and went on reading. Once we started, though, we passed them, grinning and pomaded, girls in parodies of fashion, heels and veils, all posed irresolutely, watching us go as if out on the end of an event, waving goodbye to something that survived it. Struck, I leant more promptly out next time, more curiously, and saw it all again in different terms. The fathers with broad belts under their suits and seamy foreheads, mothers loud and fat, an uncle shouting smut, and then the perms, the nylon gloves and jewellery substitutes, the lemons, mauves and olive ochres that marked off the girls unreally from the rest. Yes, from cafes and banquet halls up yards and bunting-dressed coach party annexes, the wedding days were coming to an end. All down the line, fresh couples climbed aboard. The rest stood round. The last confetti and advice were thrown, and as we moved, each face seemed to define just what it saw departing. Children frowned at something dull. Fathers had never known success so huge and wholly farcical. The women shared the secret like a happy funeral, while girls, gripping their handbags tighter, stared at a religious wounding. Free at last, and loaded with the sum of all they saw, we hurried towards London, shuffling gouts of steam. Now fields were building plots, and poplars cast long shadows over major roads, and for some 50 minutes that in time would seem just long enough to settle hats and say, "I nearly died," a dozen marriages got underway. They watched the landscape, sitting side by side. An Odeon went past, a cooling tower, and someone running up to bowl. And none thought of the others they would never meet, or how their lives would all contain this hour. I thought of London, spread out in the sun, its postal districts packed like squares of wheat. There we were aimed. And as we raced across bright knots of rail, past standing Pullmans, walls of blackened moss came close, and it was nearly done, this frail, travelling coincidence. And what it held stood ready to be loosed with all the power that being changed can give. We slowed again, and as the tightened brakes took hold, there swelled a sense of falling, like an arrow shower, sent out of sight, somewhere becoming rain. So happy birthday to him.
Days. What are days for? Days are where we live. They come. They wake us time and time over. They are to be happy in. Where can we live but days? Ah, solving that question brings the priest and the doctor in their long coats, running over the fields.
Our next section opens with writer Anne Thwaite reading a longer version of the article she has written for a Larkin special in The New Statesman. And this is followed by academic and magician Dale Sowak, friend of Professor Eddie Dawes, who had two very special encounters with Philip Larkin.
I have been thinking about Philip Larkin a lot this year, 100 years after he was born, and the year after Anthony Thwaite's death. The names of the poet and his poet editor, my husband, are inextricably linked, whether I like it or not. As a very young producer at the BBC, Anthony had selected Philip Larkin for a European service programme called Younger British Poets of Today. It included two of Philip's most loved poems, Church Going and At an Arundel Tomb, both written not long before. Their close friendship began on the 2nd of July, 1958, as they took a taxi after the recording to meet Kingsley Amis for a drink. As James Booth points out in his biography, their very different political views never hindered their relationship. Anthony's interest in Larkin had begun in 1954 when he ordered a copy of the pamphlet 20 Poems from Blackwell's in Oxford while still an undergraduate. Our interest increased, of course, when the less deceived arrived in Tokyo, where we were both teaching, early in 1956. As a literary editor later, Anthony would publish not only many of Philip's poems, but was in the position to commission regular reviews of books he thought Philip might want to read. In The New Statesman, the 14th of March 1969, for instance, Larkin reviewed Christopher Rix's splendid edition of Tennyson's poems. The editor at the time thought it one of the best reviews they'd ever printed. It can be read now in Required Writing, dedicated by Philip to Anthony. Sadly, Anthony's own signed copy of that book disappeared in a suitcase that never arrived at Calcutta Airport, as it was then, when he was on a lecture and reading tour of India. It's understandable, I think, that I should quote from Anthony himself, writing 40 years ago in the book he edited for Faber to mark Larkin at 60. He ended his introduction. The work remains unassailable, except by those who look for something in poetry other than the virtue of startling truth, memorability, skill, and poignancy embodied in Philip Larkin's poems. Anthony denied his intention was to tell readers that Larkin is really much nicer, much more normal, much more like us than both his admirers and his detractors have established. Anthony was, long before Philip's death and the subsequent letters and Andrew Motion's biography, facing the suspicion that many readers who didn't know the man had in their heads the image of a Mr. Blini, a misogynist, a miserable Scrooge. Later, worse words would be added, which I will not repeat. I will instead remember with pleasure Philip's warm friendship with R.K. Biswas, the Indian scholar, his admiration for Louis Armstrong, and his long, good relationships with women other than his lovers. I will take the opportunity to suggest to readers, unfamiliar with the poems, to begin with some of the most memorable. The Trees, familiar in London perhaps from poems on the Underground. First Sight, The Wits and Weddings, Love Songs in Age, and The Mower. That last poem ends with the lines, "We should be careful of each other. We should be kind while there is still time." We always found Philip Larkin kind, thoughtful, and far more than just excellent company. I have an almost relevant example of how letters can betray their writers. How differently men, perhaps only men, can write on the same day what different sides of themselves they can show to different correspondents. When I was planning a book for Anthony's own 50th birthday in 1980, both Philip Larkin and Kingsley Amis were among the large number of poets I'd invited to contribute. Philip took particular trouble, writing out his gloomy The View at 50, then unpublished, and adding at the bottom, "But it would have been a lot worse without you, dear Anthony." He wrote to me, "As you can see, that goes nearly into the binding at the left. I'm afraid I've spoilt it. If so, send me another sheet of the splendid paper and I'll redo it." He wrote this on the 9th of February, 1980, 2 months before Kingsley Amis wrote to him, complaining about my request. Sodding cheek, I thought it was. This was published by Zachary Leader in his edition of Amis's letters in 2000, on the page after his letter to me written on the same day. I had no idea, of course, that Amis had any such feelings when he wrote to me. "I hope Anthony is pleased with his present. He certainly should be. What a wifely wife you are. Needless to say, nobody did anything like that for my 50th. I expect your visits to London are pretty crammed, but it would be fun to see you both for lunch or something. Jolly good luck. Yours, Kingsley." I never knew Philip as well as I would have wished, and certainly not as well as Anthony did, but it pleased me that he seemed to like me and like coming to stay with us, first in Richmond, then in Norfolk. He called the Norfolk house Mole End and took photographs of it. He was always a keen photographer. Because of my enormous admiration for his poetry, my awareness indeed that he was not just the best poet of our time, but a great poet for all time, I was always slightly nervous of his coming, feeling it was a bit like having Wordsworth to stay, a bit daunting. Wordsworth was the poet who sprang to mind, I suppose, because he had himself stayed on several occasions in the late 18th century, only a couple of miles up the river at Faunces St. Peter, where his uncle was rector. We took Philip there on a wild day with rooks flying over the round flint tower and thought a poem might come out of it, but sadly it didn't. I suppose it was thinking of parallels with Wordsworth and how much I should like to know whether he had walked along the river past our house on a day 200 years ago that made me want to exercise my biographer's instinct and ask Philip Larkin the sort of detailed, trivial questions, the answers to which I would want to know if I were writing his biography. Not that I would ever want to write the biography of someone so recently dead. It was of enormous interest to us, of course, when first Andrew Motion took it on, and then 20 years later, we had James Booth's Philip Larkin, Life, Art and Love. In 1982, I was working on my biography, Edmund Goss, A Literary Landscape. Goss was himself a biographer. In 1919, when reviewing Festing Jones' memoir of Samuel Butler, he was happy to discover that Butler, when travelling abroad, kept diarrhea pills in the handle of his Gladstone bag. "These little things are my delight," he wrote. In the same way, my delight is in the trivial things Philip Larkin told me on that March evening in Norfolk 40 years ago. At the time of this visit, two of our four daughters, Alice, 16, and Lucy, 20, were at home. I wrote in my journal at the time, March the 30th, 1982, "We have Philip Larkin staying with us for a couple of nights. He asked if he could come before going on to a librarians' conference at UEA. I'm rather worried about him. He seems very unfit. He is bulkier than ever. Apparently it's all drink, not food. He talked a lot last night to me when Anthony and the girls were clearing up after supper. I find his life sad, his substance, or rather physical presence, sad. But he is himself so funny and sweet, such a sweet smile. His deafness is worse than ever. He now has hearing aids on each ear, and yet still obviously misses a great deal in general conversation, as on Sunday night, when Malcolm and Elizabeth Bradbury came to supper, and also Joanna Motion, Andrew's in New York. He talked to me of his dysmistic routines. His help at the moment comes only 3 hours a week to clean. He has taken her over from the library cleaning staff, and she'll do 6 hours very soon when she retires. Apparently, she always leaves things exactly where they are. For example, his slippers in the middle of the room, having picked them up to vacuum under them. The previous cleaner, who was very good in most ways, used to tidy things away, and he'd spend ages hunting for them. For example, his slippers under the settee. And she always turned his bedside clock so it faced the door. Presumably she had no watch and used to check her time with it, but never turned it back. He likes fine, fair grapefruit juice and gentleman relish for breakfast. Gentleman's relish is difficult to find in Hull. He will pick up a jar at Fortnum's when he's in London and also can get it in Hexham when he stays with Monica. Of course we had neither, but he had half a grapefruit. Be too much trouble for him to cut a grapefruit for himself each morning, he says, though he admitted he had a good grapefruit knife, and one slice of wholemeal toast and Marmite. He makes his bed too early each day while his bath is running, probably before it's aired, but he can't bear to have it to do later. He does everything, really, except actual cleaning. He never had a washing machine. He sends everything very extravagantly, as he admits 48 pence a shirt, to the laundry, the last individual in Hull to do so, along with the orphanages and the restaurants, he says. In the evening, having often had only a sandwich for lunch, he makes himself something hot, maybe macaroni cheese or risotto. He can make a macaroni cheese in 20 minutes and then drink 2 gins and tonic while it cooks. Sometimes he makes too much, and then he has it the next night as well. Another couple of nights a week, he'll have tinned or frozen rubbish. Probably a stew, not fish. He doesn't care much for fish. If only satsumas went on all the year. That's what he likes afterwards. So easy to peel. Anthony took him off for the day yesterday in the golf. He couldn't fit in the Spitfire. His head touched the roof. In our dining room, he has to go more or less on all fours. At one point, he got down on the living room floor, full length, looking for a metal ball Alice had lost from the maze game. Unfortunately, he didn't have the pleasure of finding it, as she did herself. Edwin and Liz Brock came in and we played the dictionary game, which he seemed to enjoy. Philip particularly liked the true definition of falsism, a platitude that is not even true. Edwin and he found they shared a common love of Cyril Connolly, and he read out that marvellous passage from 90 Years of Novel Reviewing or whatever about all the things one should not put in novels. Lucy talked to him about Jill at the meal. He was only a little older than she is when he wrote it, 21. In the marvellous freedom after going down from Oxford, presumably meaning with no essays to write or prescribed books to read, I wonder if he might write another novel when he retires. Apparently, though early retirement is so much in the air, they don't want Philip to leave. He has moments of thinking he'd like to, but I think he needs the toad, the yearly frame. What would he do anyway? He said it would be unlikely he'd write another novel. The pressure wouldn't be there. That's what makes one write. It's not the time available. Of course, it helps to be gloomy. As usual, he was grumbling about gardening, but he has cut his grass already this year. Edmund and I were lamenting the shrubs killed by the hard winter and asked him if he'd lost any. I hope so, he said, as if they were normally more trouble than they were worth, but he laughed, of course, as he said it. Philip said he'd rather go straight back to Hull than on to the conference at UEA. I suggested, trying to look on the bright side, that there might be a few people he'd enjoy seeing. Oh, he said, smiling wryly, that's going a bit far. I asked him if he'd accept the laureateship if it were offered, and he said it would be a bit pointless for there to be a dumb laureate. He told us of having lunch at the palace once when his only conversation with the Queen, who arrived at 1:30, by which time everyone else was nervously drunk. His only conversation seems to have been about Ireland. She had come from giving Willie Whitelaw an audience, and Philip tried to tell an Irish joke about them fighting peacefully, but of course she was not much amused. Princess Alexandra fired questions at him. Question, what sort of poems do you write? Answer, gloomy. Question, why are they gloomy? Answer, because I'm a gloomy sort of person. Question, why are you a gloomy sort of person? He sent her a copy of High Windows afterwards, or Faber did, as she seemed interested, but it was never acknowledged, or so he said. I remember Stevie Smith confirming at our lunch table that poetry is not a favourite subject with the royal family. Philip is thinking of making Anthony his literary executor, which makes sense. The awful thing is that we may not be talking of some far-off time, as Philip really doesn't seem likely to live to a good old age. Philip died, aged only 63, less than 4 years after that journal entry. Of course I wish I had written about earlier visits and had asked more interesting questions, but his views on all sorts of more important subjects have been recorded in a surprising number of surviving interviews. Philip died on the 2nd of December 1985. I know the Larkin Society, having planned all sorts of events for this centenary year, are hoping to mark his death date in Westminster Abbey, where a memorial stone was laid in Poets' Corner on the 2nd of December 2016. We were in Tokyo for a year when Philip died. Andrew Motion phoned to tell us the not unexpected news. Philip had written a long letter to Anthony in April when we'd arrived in Japan. It was good of you to write before going, when you must have been so busy. I felt something of a pang to know that you are now out of England. Philip had left Anthony and Andrew, not only to deal with my publishers as I would myself, but also, in general, to look after my interest and my good name. The latter has proved more difficult than Philip had imagined, but the poems remain unassailable, as Anthony said, the work of a great poet and of someone we knew as a lovable man.
The novelist Barbara Pym has been described as one of those authors who keep sending you things long after you thought she was gone. I believe the same may be said of her friend and advocate, Philip Larkin, whom I have been reading since the mid-1960s. Although he is gone, we still have the exquisite poems, we have the essays, letters, photographs, and recordings, and we have the memories and assessments of those who knew him best. Because of the generosity of my friend Edwin Dawes, former professor and head of the biochemistry department at the University of Hull, chairman of the library committee, giving him the privilege of working closely with Philip, and fellow conjurer, I was able to meet Philip Larkin on two occasions. Although Philip is a shy man, Eddie wrote, it should not be too difficult to set up a dinner party for you to meet him. That opportunity presented itself in 1982 at the Dawes home. The event was completely orchestrated by Eddie. Philip was wary and shied away from the thought that he would have to discuss his poems, but Eddie assured him. He accepted and arrived promptly at 7 p.m., dressed in a black suit, white shirt, dark green knitted tie, and carrying a brown briefcase in which he had brought copies of some review articles I had previously requested. After one of Amy Dawes' splendid dinners, we moved upstairs and performed a magic show for Philip. Later, he revealed that he had been so moved that when he returned home, he had written about it in his journal. "I should show you what I wrote," he said, but regrettably, the opportunity never developed. My second visit occurred in July 1985. This time, my wife, Patty, joined me at the Dawes home. Eddie called Philip, who said, "Yes, please come over." We spent an hour with him at his Newland Park home number 105. Monica Jones, who was unwell, remained upstairs. As the time drew to a close, Eddie took out his camera. Philip sat between my wife and me on the couch with an arm around each of us. He drew Patty close to him and said to her, who was 25 at the time, "You could be my granddaughter." Patty took to him right away. Afterwards, asked her impressions, she said two words, sensitive and vulnerable. Like me, she was much moved by the gentleness of the man and the melancholy. Several friends had told me at the time that Philip was ill. He must have suspected that this would be our last meeting. Under my arm, I carried a copy of All What Jazz with his inscription. From Philip Larkin in the Shade to Dale and Patty in the Sun, temporarily and permanently, respectively, we hope. On September 15th, 1985, my last communication with him, he wrote, "I suppose I'm getting better slowly, but the whole business has led to rather a crisis of confidence. To go through the ice of daily life means you can never forget how thin that ice is. You are always listening for the next cracking. That cracking would come sooner than any of us could guess. Sadly, Philip died at 1:24 a.m. Monday, December 2nd, 1985, in the Hull Nuffield Hospital at the age of 63, and was buried at Cottingham near Hull. Each of the letters I received from him, some handwritten, many typed, bears the stamp of their author in various ways. By turns warm, humorous, helpful, self-deprecating, generous, poignant, and always encouraging. Only later did I appreciate that Philip's private correspondence was for him what someone has called a kind of consolation and healing. As he wrote in Obad, postmen like doctors go from house to house. At the Church of St. Mary the Virgin, Kingsley Amis spoke for all readers when he said, "We take seriously what he left us. We are lucky enough to have known him. Thousands who didn't, and more thousands in the future, will be able to share his poems with us." Indeed, what the American writer Eudora Welty said of Barbara Pym's novels, we may now say of Philip Larkin's poems. Quiet, paradoxical, funny, and sad, they have the iron in them of permanence. I cannot improve upon that judgment. On December 2nd, 2016, I was privileged to attend, along with Eddie, the unveiling of a memorial stone for Philip Larkin in Poets Corner at Westminster Abbey. The inscription includes two lines from an Arundel tomb, with which I conclude. "Our almost instinct, almost true, what will survive of us is love."
We open the next section with the wonderfully rich voice of artist Grayson Perry, followed by the reflections of poet Imtiaz Darker, sculptor Martin Jennings, and writer Blake Morrison.
Vers de Societe. My wife and I have asked a crowd of craps to come and waste their time and ours, perhaps. You'd care to join us? In a pig's ass, friend. Day comes to an end. The gas fire breathes. The trees are darkly swayed. And so, dear Warlock Williams, I'm afraid. Funny how hard it is to be alone. I could spend half my evenings, if I wanted, holding a glass of washing sherry canted over to catch the drivel of some bitch who's read nothing but witch. Just think of all the spare time that has flown straight into nothingness by being filled with forks and faces rather than repaid under a lamp, hearing the noise of the wind and looking out to see the moon thinned to an air-sharpened blade, a life, and yet how sternly it's instilled. All solitude is selfish. No one now believes the hermit and his gown and dish, talking to God, who's gone too. The big wish is to have people nice to you, which means doing it back somehow. Virtue is social. Are then these routines, playing at goodness, like going to church? Something that bores us, something we don't do well, asking that ass about his fool research. But try to feel, because however crudely, it shows us what should be. Too subtle, that. Too decent, too. Oh, hell. Only the young can be alone freely. The time is shorter now for company. And sitting by a lamp more often brings not peace, but other things. Beyond the light stand failure and remorse, whispering, "Dear Warlock Williams, why, of course."
It's always interesting how Larkin plays with ideas of distance and closeness in his poems, and especially in this one that I'm going to read broadcast. The you in the poem, Maeve Brennan, is in another city at a concert, listening to the music there. And he is in another city listening to the broadcast. And that gives him all kinds of opportunities to think about that distance and the closeness again. Everything he says about the sound emphasizes vastness, giant whispering and coughing, vast Sunday for huge resettling. And everything he says about the music is a kind of rejection, The drum scuttles, snivelling, slithering, rabid storms of cording. He sets up all this distance and noise so that he can come to that last image, leaving me desperate to pick out your hands, tiny in all that air, applauding. That's uncharacteristically tender for Larkin. For him, the thought of closeness or expressing affection usually triggers a reflex pulling away, standing outside the experience, being elsewhere. As always with Larkin, the form, the rhyme scheme he uses here fits the thought perfectly. He uses an ABACCB, so there's as much distance as possible between the two Bs. Rabid storms of cording to tiny in all that air applauding at the very end of the poem. In the second stanza, he pulls back to where he is now. Here it goes quickly dark. Even with all the music in the broadcast, even in the midst of life, Larkin is always halfway to the thought of death. I'll read the poem. Broadcast by Philip Larkin. Giant whispering and coughing from vast Sunday full and organ frowned on spaces precede a sudden scuttle on the drum. The queen and huge resettling. Then begins a snivelling of the violins. I think of your face among all those faces, beautiful and devout before cascades of monumental slithering. One of your gloves unnoticed on the floor beside those new, slightly outmoded shoes. Here it goes quickly dark. I lose all but the outline of the still and withering leaves on half-emptied trees. Behind the glowing wave bands, rabid storms of cording, by being distant, overpower my mind, all the more shamelessly. Their cut-off shout leaving me desperate to pick out your hands, tiny in all that air, applauding.
This is the poem 12 from Philip Larkin's collection, The North Ship. It reminds me of the statue I made of him on Hull Paragon Station. And in particular, the line, to be each dawn perpetually journeying. It seems the fate of statues that they are forever locked into the position in which they were originally imagined by the artist. One man walking a deserted platform, dawn coming and rain driving across a darkening autumn. One man restlessly waiting a train while round the streets the wind runs wild, beating each shuttered house that seems folded full of the dark silk of dreams, a shell of sleep, cradling a wife or child. Who can this ambition trace to be each dawn perpetually journeying, to trick this hour when lovers re-embrace with the unguessed at heart riding the winds as gulls do? What lips said starset and cockcrow call the dispossessed on to the next desert, lest love sink a grave round the still sleeping head?
How many times did you meet Philip Larkin?
I suppose it must have been half a dozen to a dozen, something like that. We sat together on the Poetry Book Society. And in fact, once, because he also used to do book reviews for The Observer where I worked. And I invited him to lunch ahead of a Poetry Book Society meeting. And we got to, I don't know, about the beginning of dessert or something, and then he suddenly stood up and said, "Thank you very much, Blake." Off he went, leaving me to pay the bill.
Which of course.
Maybe the old-fashioned etiquette is if you invite somebody to lunch, you're the one paying.
Yeah.
But, in a more generous spirit, he he hosted a poetry reading that I did with Andrew Motion at the University of Hull. Of course, he loved Andrew, had worked at the university. And the fact that he was making a public appearance, you know, like that and chairing meant we had a very good turnout. I had small children at the time, and I read a poem which has a little quote from Cobbett at the beginning, which goes something like, you know, where is the man who does not adore these perfectly innocent little creatures? And even as I said it, I was thinking, there's the man who does not adore little children. But anyway, he was generous that night and took us out for a meal. So I'm not going to endorse the idea of Larkin as a mean old sod. But, you know, I was thinking about what it is that makes me such a fan of his poetry. And one of the things, I think, is just its sheer quotability. I mean, you think T.S. Eliot, Samuel Beckett, yes, they've got some good lines, but has any 20th century writer got more quotable phrases and lines than Larkin? I was just scribbling down a few of them. You know, what will survive of us is love. Mm. Home is so sad. They fuck you up, your mum and dad. Another one on home. We all hate home and having to be there.
Yeah.
Sexual intercourse began in 1963.
Yeah. We should be kind.
We should be kind while there is still time after he catches the hedgehog in the mower. Nothing like something happens anywhere. And then those First World War recruits, you know, never such innocence again. Or the young mothers he sees, something is pushing them to the side of their own lives. And then I think, you know, above anything, probably the ending of Dockery and Son, you know, life is first boredom, then fear. Mm. Well, that's pretty tremendous. You could leave it there, really, but it goes on, you know, whether or not you use it, it goes and leaves what something hidden from us chose, an age, and then the only end of age. And then, of course, you know, death, which always brings out his best lines, the solving emptiness that lies just under all we do. Not to be here, not to be anywhere, and soon. Yeah, so I think, you know, is there a more quotable poet than Larkin? I think also for those of us who are fans and feel a little bit under siege by this view of Larkin is, you know, understandably the view has developed, racist, misogynist, misanthrop, grumpy old sod and right winger, and you feel a little bit on the defensive when you say how much you admire his poetry. But I think that's partly because the poetry leaves all that stuff behind.
Yeah.
I think there's several lines in Larkin in which he sort of relishes the idea of a place cleared of him, you know, where he's absent. And in a way, the man goes absent in the poetry and this deeper self comes out. And this deeper self, it doesn't have the answers, doesn't have strong opinions. It's all about searching. You know, so many of those long poems are about fumbling towards some truth that he's trying to uncover. They're shaded by doubt, you know, ignorance, never to be sure, never to know, is a recurrent theme. So the poisonous stuff of Larkin, you know, the sewer under the National Monument and so on, to me, is barely present in the poetry. And then, of course, you know, maybe primarily, he just deals with all the big subjects, you know, sex, love, marriage, work, religion, fate and free will, and so on, and death more than anything else.
And such a lot of humour as well.
And such a lot of humour. So even the big serious themes and the big lines, there's always the jokiness and the humour.
Yeah.
And, you know, that gets, you know, in his interviews and his other pieces, that comes out. Again, very quotable, you know, deprivation is for me what daffodils were for Wordsworth. Or, you know, I wouldn't mind going to China if I could get back the same day. Yeah. That sort of, you know, wisecracking stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
But I did want to read one poem, which I never really learnt poems by heart, but I know this one by heart.
Oh, really?
I wonder whether I dare. I've got it here in case I can't do it. And it's poetry of departures. Sometimes you hear fifth hand as epitaph. He chucked up everything and just cleared off. And always the voice will sound certain you approve this audacious, purifying, elemental move. And they are right, I think. We all hate home and having to be there. I detest my room, the specially chosen junk, the good books, the good bed, my life in perfect order. So to hear it said, he walked out on the whole crowd, leaves me flushed and stirred, like, then she undid her dress, or take that, you bastard. Surely I can, if he did. And that helps me stay sober and industrious. But I go today. Yes, swagger the nut-strewn roads, crouch in the forecastle, stubbly with goodness. If it weren't so artificial, such a deliberate step backwards to create an object. Books, China, a life reprehensibly perfect. Yeah, not one of his most famous poems, but one of his, to my mind, one of his best.
We bring this episode to an end with the familiar voice of Professor James Booth, founding chairman Professor Eddie Dawes, and our current chair Rosie Millard.
Anyway, Reference Back is a classic example of this because it's the only occasion in his mature poetry where he uses the word unsatisfactory, which of course you would think this is absolutely a classic Larkin word, unsatisfactory. He's got to have used it. He'll have used it several times, won't he? Yes, but all in this poem. He doesn't use it anywhere else. He uses it four times. Well, I tell this story over and over again. People have heard it. But it's extraordinary. And the fact that he does that means that whenever you think of a Larkin poem and you think of unsatisfactory, you think of this poem. You can't think of any other poem. That's why he does it. And you think, what an extraordinary, uncanny idea of your own oeuvre to realise that there are going to be enough people who are interested enough, sensitive enough to the language to register that if a word has got some real force to it, it's only going to be in one poem. Mm. And it is. So unsatisfactory in this poem comes four times, and it doesn't come anywhere else in any of his mature poems at all. The other thing is, it's just one of those classic perfect poems, really, written in August 1955, just after a few months after he'd arrived in Hull. The pattern of his life from then on was set. He would go and visit his mother in Loughborough and Monica in Leicester, and then come back to Hull. And that suited him, and he did that for the rest of his life. So this is an early case of that, when he goes back to his mother. It's always slightly unsatisfactory. They quite often have a row, which he has to apologise for, and she then apologises to him, and it's beautiful and ceremonious. And if you read all the letters, as I did, you know, it comes over and over again, the same pattern. Very civilised, their relationship. And the relationship with his mother, of course, is a key one in his life. Here he feels guilty because he's playing his records and sitting in his room, young man into jazz. She, rather gauchely, using the wrong vocabulary altogether, says that was a pretty one about Oliver's Riverside Blues, but she should have said that was hot, or something. But he doesn't take any notice of that. He doesn't care. Pretty is fine. In fact, it is pretty, actually. It is. It's rather... I mean, pretty is not a bad word for it. It's the word she would have thought of, and it is appropriate. He then feels guilty that he's just playing records. And then he realises that this moment is going to be one of those moments in time which poems are made of, really, which he will always remember, because that piece of music will always bring it back, as pieces of music do. Little snatches will bring something back with all its force. And so this moment will come back. Anyway, I should read it. Reference Back. That was a pretty one. I heard you call from the unsatisfactory hall to the unsatisfactory room where I played record after record, idly wasting my time at home that you so much looked forward to. Oliver's Riverside Blues it was, and now I shall, I suppose, always remember how the flock of notes those antique Negroes blew out of Chicago air into a huge remembering pre-electric horn the year after I was born, 3 decades later, made this sudden bridge from your unsatisfactory age to my unsatisfactory prime. Truly, though our element is time, we are not suited to the long perspectives open at each instant of our lives. They link us to our losses. Worse, they show us what we have as it once was, blindingly undiminished, just as though by acting differently, we could have kept it so.
Centenary now this week. So what are your thoughts?
Well, elation, shall I say, that we've got to the point where we're now honouring the centenary of Philip's birth. He was 3 years older than me, and I first met him when I came to Hull as Foundation Professor of Biochemistry. Before I arrived, I had a letter from him asking me to call on him the next time so we could discuss what my library needs would be for a new subject. Mm-hmm. So that was the first meeting with him, and others followed. And I've told the story before, but the reason why I got on very well with him, I think, was right from the start. In February of 1964, just after I'd arrived, The Whitson Wedding, this was published, I bought a copy, and I had the temerity to send it across to the library and ask if he would be kind enough to inscribe it for me. I didn't realise he was touchy about that. But anyway, he did. And like all my books, I put a book plate in, which was designed so I could link and put it equally on science books and arts and whatever else, depicting an ancient alchemist with a beard and a hat on, and on a bench in front of him a copy of Baptista Porter's book from the 16th century, Natural Magic. So the book came back inscribed, and then underneath the book plate he wrote, "Not a bad likeness." So he was intrigued by my magical interest, just as I'd been intrigued by the way he was into jazz in quite a big way. So after that, we got on very well. And eventually, on the library committee representing as Dean of Science, I started to work with him on that. And at that time, it's student problems, and particularly with library matters. And Philip wanted to set up a committee that would meet with the students and round a table and discuss things. And he asked me if I'd chair it for him, so I said yes, okay. But it didn't last long, because the delegate that the Students' Union chose to join this committee was one of the worst offenders in the library. Had problems. So Philip just put the foot down. He said, "I will not sit round the table with someone like that." So that was the end of that. But happily, later on, there was a library offshoot of the library committee, which was doing that kind of work.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that was it.
What do you, when you look back on your time as chairman of the society, what sort of things are you proud of? What do you look back on?
looking back on the foundation of the Larkin Society, yes.
Mm.
Well, I was felt very honoured when I was not on a steering committee that was set up for that. And Mayor Brennan was, phoned me up on behalf of them and said they would like me to be the chairman if I would. So especially for the, you know, I'd been chairman of the library committee for the last 11 years of Philip's life. So I said yes. And that was it. So I'm delighted now to see how we've progressed and achieved the sort of targets that we had. The initial prime one, of course, get him into Westminster Abbey.
And was that a target right from the start? When it was set up.
When it was set up, we were looking at what, you know, the way ahead and what would it, where he ought to be. We felt it should be.
So that must have been very emotional for you at Westminster Abbey when you were there with Anthony.
That's right,
laying the stone.
The unveiling. Well, I started the first attempt. I learned quite a lot about what I didn't. These people who get into Poets Corner.
Yeah.
It's the existing dean who's in office has complete control over that.
Yeah.
So you've got to satisfy his criteria.
Yeah.
The first dean went up to wrote. Indicated that one of his criteria was you must be dead for 20 years before you could sit here.
Right.
So that wiped that one out for a while.
Yeah.
And then his successor came along, we renewed it. And we didn't get it immediately, but encouraging sound, shall we say. And so that did happen that time eventually, and to everyone's delight. And that December day in 2016, we achieved that.
And, of course, your other achievements, like the statue at the station.
But I mean, alongside this, of course, was all the work that was going on, which led to Larkin 25.
Yeah.
And on, which was a great boost, the City of Culture that was on the horizon as well.
Yeah.
That, Graham Chester had been the go-between the committee and our council and so forth. Did a great job there with that. So all these stepping stones I were building up, and it's pleasing that while we've got enormous numbers, they have increased.
Mm.
And Carol Collinson did a great job rustling up new members.
Yeah, she's been a force of energy for our members and our membership.
Yeah.
What do you think Philip would think of the celebration this year? If he knew what we were doing.
Well, I think secretly he would be very pleased indeed, but I doubt he would have shown it excessively.
There does seem to be a lot of affection for Philip Larkin still when you talk to people, and becoming more and more of like a national treasure, really, for the British.
Yes, it's interesting, because he went through that terrible dip, of course, after the books were published under there. But it's very interesting the way it's come back and mounted steadily.
Yeah.
And then, of course, we're now into a hullabaloo. Larkin's been taken off the syllabus today.
Well, I'm sure he'll
survive. You must have a view on that.
Yeah. I think he'll be back. I don't think he'll be off for very long. I think he'll come back.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And he's well studied at university. So I think with academics, he's very popular, or you know, there's always something to study when you look at Larkin and lots of different aspects to him. So do you want to read the poem? We talked about which poem you'd like to read, and you've chosen The Trees. Is there any particular reason why you like this one?
Well, really, I think because of the beautiful sycamore in the garden behind me here.
Yeah.
And sadly, one copper beech at the front that old age got and had to be felled. So I've always inspiration looking out over the garden. So the trees are coming into leaf like something almost being said. The recent buds relax and spread. Their greenness is a kind of grief. Is it that they are born again as we grow old? No, they die too. Their yearly trick of looking new is written down in rings of grain. Still the unresting castles thresh, full grown thickness every May. Last year is dead, they seem to say. Begin afresh, afresh, afresh.
Well, this is my favourite poem at the moment. These things do change, but this is my favourite Larkin poem. It's the opening poem in the Whitsun Weddings collection, and it's called Here. Swerving east from rich industrial shadows and traffic all night north, swerving through fields too thin and thistled to be called meadows, and now and then a harsh-named halt that shields workmen at dawn, swerving to solitude of skies and scarecrows, haystacks, hares and pheasants, and the widening river's slow presence, the piled gold clouds, the shining gull-marked mud, gathers to the surprise of a large town. Here domes and statues, spires and cranes cluster beside grain-scattered streets, barge-crowded water, and residents from raw estates brought down the dead straight miles by stealing flat-faced trolleys, push through plate-glass swing doors to their desires. Cheap suits, red kitchenware, sharp shoes, iced lollies, electric mixers, toasters, washers, dryers. The cut-price crowd, urban yet simple, dwelling where only salesmen and relations come with an interminate and fishy-smelling pastoral of ships-up streets, the slave museum, tattoo shops, consulates, grim head-scarved wives, and out beyond its mortgaged half-built edges, fast-shadowed wheat fields running high as hedges, isolate villages where removed lives' loneliness clarifies. Here silence stands like heat. Here leaves unnoticed thicken, hidden weeds flower, neglected waters quicken, luminously peopled air ascends, and past the poppy's bluish neutral distance ends the land, suddenly, beyond a beach of shapes and shingle. Here is unfenced existence, facing the sun, untalkative, out of reach. As a description of Hull, the East Riding, and Sperm Point, I think this poem, its four verses, is unmatched and is still true. It was written, the Whitsun Weddings, I've got my first edition here, 1964, so it was written 56 years ago. And there is so much about the spirit of Hull, which is summarised here. The fact that Hull, it's now a city, it's not a large town, but it is still a surprise when you come across it, because there's no suburbs really, it's just suddenly you're upon it. And its innate Victorian nature, domes and statues. And there are three moments that I love more than anything. The widening river's slow presence to explain the giant and majestic Humber estuary like that. the fact it does widen, and it's there all the time when you're in Hull. You can never escape the notion that the Hull and the Humber are there. Ships Up Streets. This was written when the dock system in Hull was still going on, so that ships would come up the Humber, come through the actual city, through an interlinked system of docks to the customs house to offload their goods, and then out down the River Hull and back out onto the Humber. And so you would have this vision of an enormous ship in a street, because you'd look at it and you wouldn't see the water. You just see the ship moving through the city. And I absolutely love the description of the experience of Spurn Point, the most easterly point in the UK. And when I was at university in Hull, we used to go out, me and a friend used to drive out to Spurn Point and just look at it and just be in unfenced existence facing the sun, because it's obviously faces east, and I go running a lot out by the Humber estuary, and the sun is just always there, untalkative, out of reach. For anyone wanting to understand why Hull is such a special and particular place in the UK, they could do a lot worse than read here. I read the first stanza of this poem in Westminster Abbey. It was a huge honour to do this on December the 2nd, 2016, when Larkin's plaque in Poets' Corner was unveiled. And it was a remarkable thing to stand in the Abbey and read these words. Philip Larkin would have probably hated it. It was a real privilege. You can just feel the whole sensibility of the place in it. It's a wonderful poem. What a great way to kick off an anthology.
Thank you so much to all our honorary vice presidents, past and present, for all their support of the Society. And thank you to you for listening. This podcast was produced by Simon Galloway, and the opening music is The Horns of the Morning by The Mechanicals Band. And as ever, if you have any comments or any suggestions, I love hearing from you, so please get in touch.
The horns of the morning are blowing, are shining. The meadow is wet with the coldest of dew. The dawn reassembles with a clash of gold.